Welcome to episode 38 of Tahrir Podcast. It is the 31st of March 2024, and today's episode is about the war in Gaza. Also addressing that are episodes 32 and 37. For episode 32, Palestinian journalist Hind Khodari joined me from the Gaza Strip, talking about what the situation was like amid the communications blackout and Israel's indiscriminate bombing of the strip. It was the first interview to break the communications blackout, was widely cited and translated into multiple languages, and even made it to print. In episode 37, I was joined by Khalil Sayed, a Palestinian political analyst, also to discuss the situation there, but through a wider angle, not strictly just about what's happening on the ground in Gaza, but also the West Bank as well as Jerusalem. It has now been more than 170 days of war, with more than 30,000 Gazans killed, among them women and children. Today, I'm joined by Mayrav Zonshein to talk about Israeli domestic politics, how the war is changing that, and how Israeli society perceives and engages with this aggressive war. Mayrav is an Israel-Palestine senior analyst at the International Crisis Group and has been covering Israeli politics and U.S. foreign policy for over a decade. Welcome on the podcast, Mayrav.
Thanks, Abdullah.
Of course. So before we get into the current catastrophic situation unfolding and unraveling in Gaza, where famine seems to have taken hold as a result of aid being effectively blocked, could you explain and put into perspective when and how the current right-wing Israeli government came together to begin with?
Sure. So we are a little over a year into this government, which I guess you could call a far-right government. I mean, Israeli governments have been quite right-wing. The one that we have now was elected in the end of 2022. And basically, it was the culmination of several rounds of elections in which the Israeli political system was paralyzed. There was no coalition that was able to be built. Netanyahu was not able to form coalition. And then there was a pause in which there was a year-long non-Netanyahu government made up of right-wing and center-right political leaders, Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett. I would say it was also a very right-wing government, but it was an anti-Netanyahu government. It included for the first time also effectively an Arab party, Mansour Abbas's the United Arab List. So that government had included an Arab party, the United Arab List, and it was kind of like a hodgepodge of very different parties, including anti-occupation parties, Arab parties. But basically, Netanyahu, in order to clutch this government, this coalition that he built, had to work with the far right, the settler nationalist far right parties, the Jewish Power Party and the Religious Zionism Party. And today, the leaders of those parties have very, very senior, important ministerial jobs. The National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who lives in the settlement near Hebron called Kiryat Arba, and Bezalel Smotrich, who is the finance minister and the head, and also a minister in the defense ministry, who has been expanding settlements in quite a meticulous way. They were brought into the government after Netanyahu had beforehand never agreed to work with them. Essentially, the right was split as a result of Netanyahu being on trial for corruption for the last few years. So you had a situation in which there were certain right-wing parties that wouldn't work with Netanyahu. He had to work with the far right. And so that's how he got to the coalition we have today.
And what are the goals or objectives of the Israeli military campaign in Gaza? And how do they differ from previous operations?
So after the October 7th attack, Israel, led by Netanyahu, came out with an objective that it had never had before in its rounds of offensives in Gaza, which was to eliminate and eradicate Hamas completely. In all the previous rounds since 2007, when Hamas took over the Strip, Israel would simply try and deter Hamas, contain Hamas, react to rocket fire. In Israeli military parlance, they call it mowing the grass. So effectively, they don't expect to root out the issue. They just expect to set back Hamas's military capabilities and give it a big, give Gaza a big kind of, to pound it in a sense and destroy much of its infrastructure. So in this case, after October 7th, the military objectives at first were just that, to destroy Hamas and also to be able to return the Israelis who have been displaced from the south and consequentially also from the north with Lebanon back to their homes. In the first couple of weeks, they didn't even talk about returning the hostages who have been held in Gaza since October 7th. It was only after public pressure by the families of the hostages that that became a war objective as well. So the main objectives since then have been destroying Hamas and getting the hostages home. So this is obviously a very different type of objective than we've seen before. However, arguably the means that Israel is using, which is just, you know, military force, bombing in air, the ground invasion, which we have seen before in Gaza, though not on this scope, are in some ways very similar to the means that Israel has used before. Obviously, again, it's a much different scope. But as far as Israel's strategy, some people argue that it doesn't have a strategy, that Netanyahu doesn't have one. Others argue that Netanyahu's strategy is an endless war. You know, we can argue and we can talk about that, but ultimately Israel's ability in 6 months to root out Hamas's military and governing capacities, despite many tactical achievements that we hear about, has been quite difficult and quite challenging. So, you know, there's obvious reasons for that, like the fact that Hamas has prepared for this attack, the fact that it has an underground tunnel network, the fact that it, you know, is operating as a kind of guerrilla network as well, not just an army. But Israel has not been able to achieve its goals ostensibly over 6 months now. And it's unclear, especially with all the criticism of not having a day after plan, which basically means not having a plan for who is going to govern Gaza, everything from administering access and humanitarian aid and distributing it to running the schools and the garbage. You know, there's nobody that's clearly going to do that. So you have a situation already now in Gaza where there's a breakdown of order without anyone really there to replace it, and Israel making it very difficult for that to happen. I could also add maybe that the far right base of the government and a far right sector within Israel has openly called for the resettlement of Israeli Jewish settlements in Gaza, which existed up until 2005 when Israel pulled its 8,000 or so citizens out of Gaza along with the army there. You've already had like some attempts to even try to cross in and start to put up tents. It wasn't a serious attempt, but there's definitely a base within Israel who not only wants to depopulate Gaza of Palestinians, or at least parts of Gaza, but also to rebuild there. And that's something that is also should be taken very, very seriously, even if it's not currently an objective or on the government agenda.
And how much sway does that far right-wing sector have on Israeli politics? And is it likely to increase?
In general, I think the body politic as a result of October 7th is and has moved to the right. And Israelis are just very, very concentrated inward on their own issues, their own trauma, their own shock. Also, many of them are affected, whether by people being killed or by being displaced. There's a lot of different things that are happening. I don't think that a majority of Israelis, if asked, would say that they want to have settlements in Gaza. But they would probably also say that they don't want to have settlements expand in the West Bank. And that's what we've seen over and over again for decades. So there is obviously a consensus that on some level that settlements are a part, let's say, and this is a justification that is used many times by Israeli leaders, that settlements are a part of how you get security. You put people on the ground, you put forces to protect them, and then you have a buffer zone and you have security and you know that it's okay. Now, that was kind of proven wrong on October 7th for various reasons, where you had, you know, this very expensive security fence breached. So it's not necessarily that the argument holds, but it's something that's used. And I think if you look de facto at what Israel has done in the 6 months so far, it has cut the Gaza Strip in half, north to south, and built a road cutting it off. It has, you know, evacuated much of the population from the northern Gaza, that's all overcrowded in the south, and it has created this de facto security buffers along its border. All those elements create a situation in which it looks like a permanent occupation of some kind, and it could down the line become something that looks like resettlement. Again, I don't know if that's likely, but it certainly shouldn't be ruled out.
What do you mean by resettlement? Do you mean resettlement in Sinai or in the Negev Desert?
Yeah, no, I was talking about the Israeli population moving into Gaza, resettling, meaning reoccupying and resettling Gaza. On the Palestinian side, there is still a very imminent, or not imminent, there's a very real fear that if Israel pushes further in its military offensive, and specifically if it invades Rafah, that Palestinians who, even if some of them are evacuated to other parts of the Strip, that there would just be chaos and catastrophe, and that they would maybe spill over or try to go into Sinai, into Egypt.
And what is the current landscape on Israeli public perception of the war? What are the camps, and what do they see as the desired outcome of this war? Well, let me put it another way. What is the state of unrest in Israel, and who is protesting, and why are they?
So it's important to understand that there's kind of like, first of all, there's a consensus in Israel that the war effort is legitimate and that Hamas has to be removed. I don't think there's very few people in Israel who think that Hamas can remain intact, and they support Israel's ongoing war to get rid of Hamas. Now, exactly how long it might take, how Israel should do it, there might be some differences. But overall, there's very, very strong consensus for it. At the same time, there's also consensus that Netanyahu is not fit to lead. First of all, his popularity was already quite low before October 7th, because he's on trial for corruption, and because he is seen as somebody who is interested in political survival more than anything else, and because he was putting, along with this far-right government, a judicial overhaul plan, which is basically a way to further diminish Israel's democratic mechanisms, centralize power, and basically render the court system meaningless. So there was already very, very strong, unprecedented protests against Netanyahu and his government before October 7th. So that only became more acute and exacerbated after. But Israelis haven't really started protesting strongly until recently. Now, when it comes to the war effort, as I said, Israelis support the war effort, but they also want to see the hostages come home, and they now have reached a point 6 months in where we've had one short ceasefire and hostage deal that released about 100 hostages. And since then, 4 months later, we haven't had any movement. They are at a point, the families of the hostages, most of them, as well as I think a large sector of Israeli society, that believe that Netanyahu is simply not interested and not willing in reaching a deal for his own political interests. What that means is that two things. One, that Netanyahu is concerned that the concessions that he would have to make in a deal, which includes not only releasing Palestinian prisoners and other concessions regarding the Gaza Strip, but also effectively having a ceasefire that could last for many, many weeks, and the U.S. hopes could turn into a permanent ceasefire, that these are prices that are too high for the far right to pay, and that they would leave the coalition and break up the government and force elections. So for his own political survival, people believe that he's avoiding to do that. And also the fact that there would be a ceasefire at all, even if the coalition doesn't break up, would allow Israelis some relief and focus more and more on the domestic political issue, which is that they want an election. The majority of Israelis believe since October 7th that Netanyahu is largely responsible for the failure, that his whole policy and concept on Hamas in Gaza was wrong, and that he should step down and be accountable. So they want elections. Some of them want them immediately. More and more want them immediately. Some have called for them when the war ends. So you have this weird combination of vehement opposition to the leader of the war, but still strong support for the war. And again, Israelis are 6 months in, have very little clarity on where this war is going, on when they can return to their homes, on what exactly this government wants, because the war cabinet itself is comprised of Netanyahu and several of his political rivals, Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, who are both former IDF chiefs of staff, and they are his political rivals. They entered the war cabinet a few days after October 7th, reasoning that they want to be in the room to help make decisions that are good for Israel, despite their opposition to Netanyahu. So they have become the representatives in some ways of the need for a hostage deal, even if it means a very high price. Whereas the other elements, at least some, or Netanyahu specifically in the war cabinet, have seemed to be quite reluctant to that. So you do have some political divisions within even the decision makers about how to go about this. The defense minister, for example, he's very, very hawkish. He seems to also be a little bit more kind of open that either that we... I mean, he's been talking about the need for military force to get the hostages out. But for example, I think he might think to cooperate more with the U.S. on its notion of having some kind of revised Palestinian Authority enter Gaza. So there are some shades of difference. But ultimately, for the most part, the Israeli decision makers and the body politic want to press on until Hamas is destroyed, which does not seem like it's going to happen anytime soon.
And how has media coverage of the conflict influenced public perceptions and understanding of the humanitarian crisis, including famine in Gaza, both in Israel and internationally? Is it denied altogether or outright cheered on in Israel?
Yeah, well, obviously, I mean, Israel, you know, it has its mainstream media, it has far right media, it has independent, more left-wing media, so it's not like a monolith, but on a whole... the mainstream media is very much an arm of the government, and it tends towards propaganda. A lot of the military journalists and analysts are simply repeating the military and IDF spokesperson's narratives. Israelis are not allowed into Gaza for years now. They don't cover from there. Also, Israel has closed off Gaza to the press in general. So Israelis on a day-to-day basis are not being exposed to the suffering of Gazans. I don't think they understand the extent to which how bad it is. But the famine report that came out recently, and in general, the warnings of the dire situation there, there are some reports in Israel about it, but they usually are framed in a way that question, challenge, and undermine the reliability of these reports. Oftentimes, it's either because the Gaza Health Ministry statistics are involved, or because the UN as a body is considered, anti-Israel or belligerent against Israel. So those reports are not taken at face value. And it's not that Israelis don't consume other media. They can open Al Jazeera. They can open other things. It's so there are people who obviously read other things. But in general, it's primarily that I don't think Israelis care about what's happening in Gaza, and that was already the dehumanization of Palestinians on a whole, and just the disinterest in Palestinians was something that was long before October 7th, and it just became more and more exacerbated. Some people will argue that Israelis know exactly what's happening and they just don't care. I would say that it's also a mixture of that and just them not being able to like emotionally have any space to even think about it or cope with it, and just kind of be in some form of denial about it. But unfortunately, the media here doesn't do its job. It doesn't question the Israeli narrative very much. And most of the debates that happen, and even those are very shallow, are about the hostage crisis and whether or not Netanyahu is really interested in reaching a deal and kind of the inner workings of the internal politics within Israel. There isn't any questioning about whether Israel's strategy in Gaza is effective or not effective. And also all the international condemnation that we're seeing, the International Court of Justice, all of those mechanisms that are starting to come into play more and more, Israelis primarily respond to it by feeling even more isolated and reacting with, sometimes accusations of anti-Semitism, and basically just not really dealing with the substantive issues, instead kind of just even further feeling like they have to work and fight against the whole world on their own.
Many argue that Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu is continuing the war indefinitely to prevent elections that, if he loses, may expose him to legal action. So what do you think about that statement?
I mean, basically the situation has been for quite a while now that he's on trial for corruption. And as opposed to a regular minister in the government, if you have been indicted for corruption, you aren't able to serve as a minister. But as prime minister, he has some immunity on that. I mean, he has immunity. So legally in Israel, he's allowed to serve despite being currently on trial. Of course, many people believe he should have already stepped down as a result of his corruption trial, and he hasn't. And so the situation since he came back into power is such that people believe that he is even more vigorously holding on to power because he understands not only that he will be voted out next time at this point, but that then he will lose his immunity and could very, very well, you know, face jail time. As you know, the court process is very, very slow and it could take several more years, but eventually he could be convicted and see jail time. And so I think he's doing everything in his power to avoid that.
And in the background as well, Israel has been attacking the West Bank, which is far from Gaza and Hamas rule, and driving out more Palestinians out of there and further building illegal settlements in the process. So how do you view what's happening there, and how has the war affected this process of illegal settlement building?
Yeah, well, up until October 7th, I was very much focused on what was happening in the West Bank. There was higher levels of Palestinians killed in 2023 than since the Second Intifada in the early 2000s. Hundreds of Palestinians being killed, primarily by soldiers, but also by Israeli settlers, and settler violence as a phenomenon in which Israeli citizens who live in settlements in the occupied West Bank and are armed and are fully authorized to act as an official security arm of the military have been shooting at Palestinians, have been many things that we don't hear about, violence like blocking access to their agricultural land, intimidating them, harassing them, just like a whole landscape of different things the settlers do in order to intimidate Palestinians. And even before October 7th, we saw that many Palestinian communities, rural Palestinian shepherds in very isolated areas of the West Bank, in the south and east of Ramallah towards Jericho, in these areas, that they were already basically facing forcible expulsion as a result of settler violence. And as a result of, when I say settler violence, what I mean is settlers doing things that the army knows well about and doesn't do anything about. So basically, effectively an arm of the state. And when October 7th happened, this became much, much worse. All of the eyes were on Gaza. And also we had a very, very disconcerting phenomenon in which many of the Israelis who are settlers in the West Bank, who are armed, were then recruited into the army, into reservist duty to protect their communities, because much of the soldiers that were normally stationed in the West Bank were moved to the south with Gaza or in the north with Lebanon. And so what you have is people who are have a clear interest in harassing Palestinians, now doing it instead of in civilian clothing, in military clothing. And so all of the phenomenons and trends that we are used to and that we've seen in the West Bank of violence against Palestinians rose sharply in the weeks and months after. And you've also had a lockdown in the West Bank. You've had basically the army shutting it down in similar ways that we saw in response to the Second Intifada, where it's very difficult from get to one area to another. And also the Palestinians who work every day in Israel were barred from entering the West Bank, barred from entering Israel to work in Israel since October 7th. So the economy, which is already, in a dire situation before October 7th, is now coming to a grinding halt. It's actually an ongoing disaster in the West Bank that it's pretty amazing that you don't have more unrest happening there. And Israel also is, heavily, heavily surveilling the West Bank, and it does sweeping arrests and raids. It also uses drones in places like Jenin and Nablus to catch what they say are terrorists. So you just have constant raids, constant attacks, and thousands upon thousands of Palestinians have been arrested, many of them and without charge or trial in the months since October 7th. So we've really seen a much, much deteriorating situation on all levels. And again, the the focus is on Gaza at this point, and on the north with Hezbollah in Lebanon. So it's very difficult to see the world responding currently to what's happening in the West Bank. That said, we have seen that the Biden administration has taken note of what's happening, and he has started to put sanctions on individual settlers. But unfortunately, for now, that's largely, you know, been symbolic and hasn't really had an impact on policy or on those specific individuals.
And what do you think, now that you mentioned Lebanon, what do you think is the likelihood of another front opening there on the border?
I mean, this is an issue that, you know, I've been worried about for 6 months, and I have a hard time predicting one way or another, but I think it's quite clear now that we've been in this paradigm for months that neither Israel nor Hezbollah, nor Iran for that matter, of which Hezbollah is the major proxy, are interested in all-out war. What we have is a war of attrition, and what you have is effectively 80 to 100,000 Israelis who are have been moved out or have moved out of their homes along the border with Lebanon. That on its own is probably considered quite a strategic win for Hezbollah. And Israel has not figured out yet what to do there because it needs to have a permanent ceasefire in Gaza in order to be able to have some form of returning to normalcy in the north, because Hezbollah has tied the fate of the north to what happens in Gaza. And Israel is currently not interested in a ceasefire in Gaza. Now, Israel has used a lot of very strong rhetoric about its willingness and readiness to invade Lebanon with ground troops or to kind of have an all-out war. The price that would be for Lebanon is humongous, but the price for Israel, considering Hezbollah's buildup and its missiles and precision-guided weapon, would be extreme. And so, again, I don't think that that's ultimately what even the hawkish Israeli ministers are looking for. They've also prioritized the front in Gaza. But because you have this constant escalation where Israel is taking advantage of this paradigm in which it sees that Hezbollah is very calculated in its responses, and Israel is taking out targets all the time, both human targets, Hezbollah operatives, Hamas operatives, but also military weapon infrastructure, it's trying to do so in a way that it could never do so before October 7th because it would have sparked a major escalation. So it's taking advantage doing that. And if it makes a mistake and kills 50 civilians in one of these strikes, that could spark a war. And the opposite, if Hezbollah kills a bunch of civilians in a strike, then that could also. So we have this this situation where at any moment it could de-escalate further. So there's no guarantees, but I think ultimately we're in a paradigm where nobody wants to have this escalation, and the best thing would be to get a ceasefire in Gaza and then work on that in order to reach understandings in the north. Unfortunately, that's not happening, but that's, I think, where we need to get to.
And what would it take to reach a ceasefire?
That's a difficult question because it seems like at the current situation, both sides aren't really fully interested in one. I think obviously both sides have strong interests and they are negotiating. I think ultimately the sticking point here is that Hamas wants Israel to stop, come back its troops. Excuse me. And Israel is simply not willing. Of course, there's also the issue of Netanyahu's political interests in continuing the war. He's talked about this total victory, which nobody takes seriously, but which allows him to continue on and on with this war. And as I said earlier, a lot of Israelis believe he's not actually interested in a ceasefire. I think, again, Hamas, has been pretty consistent that there's certain things that it won't accept for a ceasefire, like Israel remaining in the north, and other aspects of basically just stopping the war. So I think to get to a ceasefire, you'll have to have a lot more pressure on Netanyahu to kind of, and we're seeing some of that internal pressure happening, because even though he wants an endless war and he has been able to kind of do that for a while now, there's also moments in which, like we are in now, where it seems like it can't go on forever because the Israeli public opinion will eventually start to break, both on the hostage issue and on the fact that there's just no answer for how they're supposed to go back to the borders. So I think it, you know, ultimately it can't go on forever. But the main key is probably for the U.S. to put some genuine pressure. It's only now started to push back a little bit with Israel's threats to invade Rafah, but it hasn't done anything that's actually changed Israeli policies, even on the humanitarian access issue. So there would have to be a lot more concerted U.S. and international pressure. And I think that combined with some of the internal dissent that we're starting to see in Israel could lead to a ceasefire.
And now that you mentioned American and international pressure, how do Israelis generally view their level of international support right now?
Well, from the beginning of the war, Israelis were extremely happy with Biden. They thought Biden was much more empathetic to them and their issues than Netanyahu himself, and that he came in and said to Israel, basically, we have your back, both diplomatically and militarily. And he really did send a clear message also to Israel and to the axis of resistance that the U.S. will get involved if there is a regional escalation with Iran and its proxies. And so I think most Israelis and certainly the security establishment understand and appreciate how important that is. But when you look beyond the U.S. and you look at the international community and specifically human rights organizations and the U.N., Israelis feel like they are very much forgetting about the hostages, not prioritizing the sexual crimes that they claim were committed on October 7th, and in general, just way too focused on Gaza and not focused enough on what Israel is going through. And, you know, aspects of violations of international law, this is something that I think most Israelis are not concerned with. And the military establishment understands very well that there could be major implications for its actions further down the line. But Israelis in general feel like they're under pressure to stop a war that they have to continue because it's a matter of their national security and an existential threat.
And to go off of that, what lever, if any, would be most effective to restrain Israel more? Because apparently the ICJ and the UN Security Council failed at doing that. So what options are there at this point?
I mean, I don't think it's realistic, but we know that Israel relies on the U.S. for both its diplomatic abilities in the U.N. and in other forums, but also, and the most important, is the weapon supplies. Israel could not continue to operate as it does without the U.S. Weapons and aid. And there's been a lot of talk in D.C. now about it, and something that was, you know, very much still taboo in American politics and within the Democratic Party specifically has now become an open debate. I don't see it happening anytime soon under the Biden administration, but I do think that ultimately if the U.S. decided to put a deal on the table for a ceasefire and then say, if we don't go to this deal, we're not going to be able to continue to support you with weapons, that would be enough. I can't see how, you know, even if Netanyahu was still pushing back on it, I believe that his cabinet and the military would say this is the red line, we have to stop. It's just very hard to see that happening also because the U.S. has a vested interest in keeping Israel's qualitative military edge over other countries that Israel is at war with. And in general, the U.S., of course, has a long history of supporting Israel. And also, both Biden and Trump or whoever will be the nominee use Israel in their own domestic political campaigns. And so stopping support for Israel in the middle of the worst war it's ever faced since its founding would not be the best political move for a U.S. president. So again, it's hard to see it happening, but I believe that would be what would ultimately make Israel stop.
And are there domestic factors preventing humanitarian aid from reaching Gaza?
domestic factors, you mean Israeli political factors?
Both, Paul, political and society as well. Because there have been multiple activists blocking a crossing point.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the humanitarian access situation is a bit complicated in terms of understanding how much aid is going in and how it's going in. But actually, the crisis group has a report coming out soon about that that I think will be very helpful if people are interested. But effectively, Israel closed off the almost all the land border crossings into Gaza. And as you said, there have been protests that in some cases, very few, but have even managed to block some of the aid going in. But ultimately and primarily, Israel has used aid and humanitarian access for Gazans as a bargaining chip in this war. First, when the war started, the defense minister and others called for a total siege of water, of electricity, of aid to cut off. And this was kind of also a way of Israel saying, you know, we left Gaza in 2005 and now we're just done. We don't want to deal with it. Of course, that's not something that's, you know, you can actually do. They have legal obligations. They have moral obligations. But this was the kind of attitude that started the war and has continued in a lot of ways. Now, as the humanitarian situation has deteriorated rapidly, especially in the last few weeks, and it's not just the aid, how much aid is getting in, it's also how that aid is distributed to people who are now have homeless, and there's a breakdown of order, and some of the Hamas police have been targeted. You basically, you know, and the aid agencies like UNRWA, for example, Israel is basically trying to eliminate it by cutting its funding. So there's nothing to replace that. So you have, it's also just the element of war. When you have a war in any situation, even if Israel is interested in getting all the humanitarian aid in, it's very hard to make that effective when you're, you know, dodging bombs and fire. So I think there are Israeli officials who understand that they need to get the flow of humanitarian aid in order to gain or to retain some of the legitimacy for this war. But ultimately, even Israel's efforts in the last few weeks, even the maritime border plan, the corridor that the U.S. is building to get in aid from the Mediterranean, none of that is going to be enough because you have a crisis in Gaza, and now that crisis is just exploding. So none of these responses are enough. And I think there is, again, a lot of Israelis who believe that Gaza shouldn't get aid as long as they're holding hostages and refusing to, you know, stop shooting rockets. And so it's a real problem. And again, on that issue, the U.S. has understood that the situation is getting drastically worse and it has to try and respond. So that's also something that seems like is reaching an inflection point where we might see, hopefully, a ceasefire or at least some change in how that's happening.
And Netanyahu has been teasing a Rafah operation for the past couple of weeks now. So how would that look like? And what are the options that, maybe through mainstream media, how are they dealing with the fact that there are more than a million Gazans currently displaced at Rafah with the border with Egypt? How are they handling that? Is the option that they would be, quote, temporarily resettled in the Negev desert, is that a viable option? Or has that been dismissed altogether? And now what mainstream media is focusing on is displacing them into the Sinai.
So the threat of an invasion into Rafah has been heard now for months, really, couple of months. You know, as far as like a military plan, you want to take out all of Hamas's battalions, and they still have several battalions left in Rafah. So like, you know, that it's clear that Israel has to go into Rafah at some point. But Netanyahu's threat to go into Rafah, you know, any day or immediately or soon, is basically been mostly an empty threat and a ploy. First, it's a way for him to gain leverage in the negotiations against Hamas. It's also a way for him to pander to his base and say, look, I'm going all the way. I'm not going to stop, even if the U.S. says so. So there's many different reasons why he's been dangling this threat. Now, again, it's not that I don't think that Israel is going to eventually try to go into Rafah, but the U.S. has put a lot of opposition to it now. And also, it's important to understand that the catastrophe that we're seeing in northern Gaza as a result of the breakdown of order and lack of food is going to be 10 times worse in Rafah because of the fact that most Gazans have moved there. And as you said, that the fact that they're close to the border with Egypt. There's no plan or there's no thought of resettling anyone from Gaza inside Israel's borders. That's not something that's ever been taken seriously. Now, Israel has also assured that it's not going to push people out into Sinai. But again, if you have a disaster there, if Israel's ground troops move in, it's very hard to see, even if Israel takes steps to evacuate the Gazans to other parts of the strip, which again, won't be safe, and it's overcrowded, and it's not hygienic, and it's not a good plan. But even if it did do that, I think it would still be a catastrophe that could lead Palestinians to try and go into Sinai just because of the desperation. And again, the U.S. and Egypt have made very clear that that's a red line. And so we have to see what happens. But at this point, Israel, for various reasons, including the fact that there aren't enough Israeli soldiers currently recruited because them were just in Gaza for months and released from duty for a break, and because of the logistics that would be required to implement this operation and move the civilians out of the way in Rafah, that would take weeks to happen. So it's not something that can happen anytime soon. But again, because Netanyahu has an interest in kind of prolonging and delaying everything, it is possible that even after a hostage deal, we would see some kind of operation in Rafah. And even with the U.S. opposition, we could still see some formulation in which Israel goes into Rafah on some level. So that's the situation.
So Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, the right-wing radicals, aren't they from the same sect that isn't obligated to serve in the IDF?
Yes, there are religious ultra-Orthodox Jews who don't serve in the army. In the case of, it's a little complicated because in the case of Smotrich, he went into the army, I believe, for a few months and then somehow got out. I don't remember the whole story. And Ben-Gvir, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who grew up in a very radical settlement, he was denied going into the army because of his nationalist racist background. He was basically active with a party, that was run by Meir Kahana, which was outlawed in the 80s. He grew up as part of this movement and he was convicted several times. That's the reason why he wasn't allowed into the army. He was convicted of incitement to racism and violence several times in his life, and so he wasn't allowed to go in the army. So that's a little bit different from the 10-13% of the population in Israel, which are ultra-Orthodox, which means that they study Torah all day. They go to these religious seminaries, and they receive budgets from the states. They receive budgets from the government in order to be able to study and not to go into the army. So that's a separate issue.
But do they have any sway in politics?
No, the ultra-Orthodox parties have a very strong play in government, and because the way that Israeli parliamentary politics works, the ultra-Orthodox parties, when they go into a coalition, they have specific demands, and they can make or break a coalition. So for Netanyahu, for the last 20 years or so, he's understood the importance of working with these parties and getting their support, and so he gives them what they need, and they support him as prime minister, and that's been the case, including now. Where he's had much of the right wing to defect from him because of his trials. They play a very important role in that sense, in being able to affect parliamentary politics and push their agenda through in the government.
So lastly, how do you see this war ending?
Well, the way I'd like to see it ending is a full ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire, and getting the hostages back. But unfortunately, I don't see that happening anytime soon. Unfortunately, the way things are going, this war on various levels in various ways could continue for many, many years. Similar to what we saw when Israel invaded Lebanon and then remained in southern Lebanon for many years. Similar to how Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967 and has remained and settled the West Bank for many, many years. So it could be that Israel, it has basically taken over parts of Gaza and it could stay there for quite a long time. I really hope it's not the case, but I feel like some level of targeted operations and army presence in parts of Gaza could go on for many years. There is some hope that the U.S. would and Arab countries, together with mediation in the negotiations for hostage deal with Qatar, would all somehow come together, together with the incentive of normalizing Israel, normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia, which is still, you know, Biden's major kind of policy to get out of this crisis. Again, all these things, they don't answer the immediate needs of the population in Gaza. So even if all those things happened, I don't know if it would be enough right now. So the only real hope on the table is that some kind of ceasefire hostage deal can come through as soon as possible. And then once that happens, I think things will start to shift both within Israel and also in terms of the U.S. Ability to put on more pressure. And it also depends, of course, on the November election in the U.S. There's a lot of wild cards and a lot of things that are hard to predict. But the only way that this war can end is ultimately for Israel to agree to stop the fire. So it has to find either there has to be enough pressure put on it, or the internal domestic protests in Israel have to be so extreme that they're not even calling for a ceasefire yet. They're calling for elections. But if that happened in a few months' time, then we could see a different leader who would at least, I think, try to get the hostages home and get a ceasefire.
Thank you so much for coming on Tahrir Podcast, Mayor.
Thank you very much for having me.